Well, thanks, Philip, and boy, that's a good introduction. I'm really pleased to be here, and I must say I'm very grateful to Philip and John for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to speak. This talk is really from a global perspective, I guess. I'm looking at the issue of child survival, particularly from the point of view of the role of vaccines and new vaccine introduction in developing countries as a mode of improving child survival, but mainly from the point of view of the role of research, who pays for the research, and how has that changed over the last 20 years, and what are the consequences of those changes. And I hope that by the end of this talk that will sort of fit together. Now, basically, my first slide is about the Millennium Development Goals, which have already been introduced by an earlier speaker today. And the Millennium Development Goals were really devised around 2000, but they are a set of goals, of health and development goals, that relate to the year 1990. So Millennium Development Goal 4, for example, which relates to child survival, is a two-thirds reduction in child mortality by the year 2015, referenced to 1990 levels. And it's a strange way to do it, in a way, because it sort of set the bar somewhat 10 years back from the time when the MDGs were first formed. But it means that we are now in 2013, very close to the time when the MDGs will be sort of measured. And in fact, it's a dangerous time because increasingly, countries that are not on track, so-called, to meet Millennium Development Goal 4 are pushed into short-term and sometimes unsustainable strategies to try and improve child survival. And sometimes that's good because they may be strategies that have good long-term outcomes, but sometimes it's inefficient and inappropriate. And I feel like now, at 2013, we should probably stop talking about the MDGs and start setting our goals somewhat more distant into the future. So having said that, this is the only slide I'm going to put up which speaks about the MDGs, but it's really just to show you that the global child mortality rates have been falling steadily, it says here since 1980, but it really goes back to 1960, where we knew something about the child mortality rates in the developing world. And there's been a steady decline right up to the present time. The yellow area on this graph shows the extent to which the current trend differs from what the world would need to achieve MDG 4, in other words, the sort of gap. As I'll say tomorrow, I don't really think it's that helpful to look too closely at this information, because as we get closer and closer to these targets, the validity and indeed the reliability of the data gets probably worse and worse. Nevertheless, this is the sort of world that we're operating in, and since 1990, or certainly since 2000, new vaccine introduction has been a part of countries' efforts to reduce child mortality. So this talk is really about new vaccine introduction and its role in improvements in child survival. Now, I would class the introduction of new vaccines into the developing world into two broad areas. The first of those vaccines, which are really only relevant to conditions of the developing world. And here are the two that I've chosen here, are dengue and malaria, two very important diseases for which vaccines are under development, or I would say, sadly, still under development for both of those conditions. I'm not really going to cover those, except to make the comment that responsibility for full evaluation of those vaccines, both in terms of safety and effectiveness, has been taken on by both the companies that are producing the vaccines and public-private partnerships that have accelerated that introduction. And so I would leave this really for another talk. This talk is going to focus on those vaccines which have global applicability, but whose role and importance in the developing world is substantial and probably greater than it is in the developed world. And I've listed three vaccines here: hepatitis B, Haemophilus influenzae type B, or HIB, and pneumococcal vaccine. Each of these were developed roughly 10 years apart. So hepatitis B came on the scene in the early 80s. The HIB vaccine was licensed in 1990, and then the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine licensed in the year 2000. For people who are not familiar with these conditions, hepatitis is well known, and it's the precursor of liver cancer, which is a major cause of adult death in the developing world. Haemophilus influenzae type B, HIB, was, before vaccine was introduced, the main cause of childhood meningitis throughout the world and a dominant cause of other serious infections, particularly pneumonia. Pneumococcus, or Streptococcus pneumoniae, remains probably the main bacterial cause of childhood death throughout the world, most of those deaths due to pneumonia, but a good number due to meningitis as well. So these are bacterial causes, this is pneumococcus and HIB, which have become amenable to vaccines. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about the story of those vaccines, how they were developed and implemented, and particularly where the support came from and what the consequences were of that. So the story goes back to 1991. At this time, HIB vaccine was available, was actually introduced in the United States, was not in use in New Zealand or Australia, and in fact in Australia at the time it was considered to be too expensive. And I can remember giving a talk on this at the Children's Hospital in Melbourne in 1991 when we were actually doing research in West Africa into this vaccine and being fairly seriously criticised by people for taking a vaccine which was far too expensive to be used in the developing world and just doing these experiments on African children. You shouldn't be doing that kind of thing. So, things have changed. But the important thing in 1991 was that there were some unknowns out there that we felt were somehow standing in the way of HIB vaccine use in the developing world. And the developing world was known to have a much heavier disease burden. The transmission of bacteria between children was much heavier and more intense. Much younger children were affected. So children with HIB disease in Africa, typically the average age was about 5 months, whereas in this country it would have been 18 months, for example. And most importantly, pneumonia was the dominant manifestation of HIB disease in the developing world, whereas in countries like New Zealand it was meningitis. Now, there were reasons to think that a vaccine that was effective against meningitis may not be effective against pneumonia. Why should that be? Well, meningitis caused by bacteria has to go through a stage where the bacteria are multiplying in the blood. So the child usually acquires the organism into the nasopharynx. Then by some means, the bacteria gets into the bloodstream. There is a phase when the bacteria is circulating in the blood, and then it settles in the meninges around the brain or sometimes in other parts of the body and causes invasive disease. So during that bacteremic phase, when the bacteria is in the blood, that's the time when a vaccine can actually stop the process. So it's easy to believe that a vaccine could prevent meningitis, but in the case of pneumonia it may be different, because whilst some cases are probably the result of blood-borne spread, as I've described, others are likely to be caused by direct spread, a child simply inhaling some infected mucus down into the lung, and the bacteria multiply causing pneumonia. So how could a vaccine stop that? So there was a very serious question out there: does this vaccine prevent pneumonia as well as meningitis? And it was so serious that in 1992 UNICEF made a very strong statement saying basically that they would not support the introduction of HIB vaccine into the developing world unless there was evidence that the vaccine prevented pneumonia. So that was a sort of a challenge that was laid out to the scientific community by UNICEF, essentially. And the response came from multiple sources. The British Medical Research Council, which both Philip and I worked for, has a big base in the Gambia, and they essentially took on the task of trying to resolve these questions, but they had a lot of supporters, and I've listed them here. NIAID is one of the US National Institutes of Health, and they provided most of the funding. Other funding came from the USAID, also directly from UNICEF, and from something which was called the Children's Vaccine Initiative. Pasteur Meyrieux was the company that produced the vaccine that we evaluated. Now, it was a French company, and they provided the vaccine free of charge, and they also did some laboratory tests free of charge. But apart from that, they had nothing to do with this trial. And that's quite important, because this is an important way that this whole field has changed over the last 20 years. At the same time, a study was being done in Chile, which was really a retrospective analysis of a previous introduction study, also looking at the same questions. But I note this just to say that the US NIH also supported the Chile study, and CDC also provided support there. So this was the range of donors who were providing money to answer these questions. The Gambia trial was a classic randomised controlled trial, individually randomised. The primary outcomes were all invasive HIB disease. In other words, a child becomes sick and the bacteria is isolated either from the blood or from the cerebrospinal fluid. Or proven HIB pneumonia, in other words, a case of pneumonia where the child is known to be bacteremic and the HIB bacteria is found in the blood. Now, we know that that is a very insensitive way of detecting HIB pneumonia, that most HIB pneumonia cases are actually blood culture negative, but nevertheless, it was the best means that we had to determine cases of HIB pneumonia. This was a double-blind trial. Nobody knew who had the vaccine and who didn't. And the placebo was avoided by mixing the vaccine with DTP, which was a standard vaccine that was given at the time. So children either received DTP mixed with HIB vaccine or DTP alone. We needed a large sample size, so 42,000 infants of 2 months of age were recruited into this trial, and it was a big undertaking. And after 3 years, this was the result. Very simple. All invasive disease, we had in children who'd had 3 doses of vaccine, we had 20 cases, 19 of them were in the control group. In other words, in the vaccinated group, 18 cases were prevented, which corresponds to a vaccine efficacy of about 95%. In the case of HIB pneumonia, we had 10 cases that were blood culture positive, all of them in the control group. In other words, on average, one would expect that there would have been 10 cases in the vaccinated group had they not received the vaccine. Therefore, the vaccine efficacy was 100%. Now, if this had been a study that had been supported by industry, I put it to you that everything would have stopped there. Those were the primary endpoints. Those were exactly the questions that we wanted to answer. And I'm sure that an industry-funded study would never have gone to the next stage. But we were sort of concerned about this. When you look at it, is this all you get from vaccinating 42,000 children? Vaccinate 42,000 children and you prevent 10 cases of pneumonia? Didn't seem like much of a yield to us. And it's not that many cases of meningitis, but the meningitis cases on their own would probably justify the use of the vaccine. But we knew that there would be a lot of cases of pneumonia amongst those 42,000 children, so 10 cases. And the other thing was that when I presented this around the same time in Australia, one of the physicians in the audience, and I seem to remember that it was Graham Barnes, who was actually a New Zealander who is based at the Children's Hospital in Melbourne, asked me the question and said, "Don't you think that your vaccine might affect the sensitivity of blood culture for the detection of HIB in the pneumonia in children who've received the vaccine?" In other words, is it plausible that the only thing the vaccine did was it changed the sensitivity of the test? In other words, you take blood from a child who's been vaccinated, it's full of antibodies against the bacteria, the child still has HIB pneumonia because the vaccine hasn't prevented it, but when you inject the blood into blood culture media, it doesn't grow. So you think that you've prevented the cases. So I became very worried about this. and started to think, well, maybe this is a completely false result, that we've just set out to look for the wrong thing. So we decided to look at the x-rays, and we had about 1,200 x-rays from about 1,900 episodes of pneumonia. And we devised a way of looking at the x-rays. Now, I'm not a radiologist, and I'm probably less of a radiologist now than I was then. But, you know, I can see that this is an abnormal x-ray. Right? Now, what we decided to do was to take these kind of pneumonia cases, and for the non-physicians here, essentially this whole area of the right lung here is full of fluid. And we know from experience that if this child is acutely ill with a fever, this is basically full of pus, and this is typical severe lobar pneumonia. So these were the cases we looked for, and we pulled them out of all of the cases of pneumonia that had been investigated. And we then had we developed a panel system and a system of reading the x-rays, which actually has now been developed into a standard way that has been applied to all of the pneumonia trials that have been conducted since then. But the finding was that 451 were positive for pneumonia, 200 in the vaccinated group, and 251 in the control group. In other words, about 50 cases were prevented. Not 10, but about 50 cases were prevented by the vaccine. And this turned out to be very important information. And those findings really were the findings that were most publicised and probably had more to do with the introduction of the vaccine into Africa than anything else. I think if we'd stuck with the 10-0 result, it would have just gone into a medical journal and people would have kind of continued. But this idea that actually 20% of all pneumonia could be due to Hib, and that that 20% could be prevented by a vaccine, was the result really of not a primary analysis or a secondary analysis, but a tertiary analysis. It was not something that we set out to do. Now, the Hib story, of course, continues. But at the time when we finished this work, there were two outstanding issues. One was the burden of disease, particularly in Asia, because even then, in the early 90s, people were saying, "Well, we don't have Hib disease in Asia; it's an African problem." Despite the fact that all European and North America, South America, everyone else had Hib disease, but Asia, it seems, didn't have Hib disease. The other question was the need for a booster dose remained as a question. So, jump forward now to 1997. And in 1997, now 7 years after the vaccine was introduced in the United States, by 97 the vaccine was in routine use in this country and had more or less eliminated Hib meningitis, as it did in Australia. A meeting was held in Bali of the Children's Vaccine Initiative, and this included a whole range of groups, WHO, UNICEF, and various other players. And after an extensive review of all the literature, the chair of the meeting, who was David Salisbury, who later went on to become the chair of WHO's Strategic Advisory Group on Immunisation, made this conclusion. There is insufficient evidence to support the use of Hib vaccine in Asia, period. So that sort of stopped dead the introduction of Hib vaccines in Asia, and it was essentially a call for somebody to do something, but no one was quite sure who that was going to be. So a trial was proposed, a cluster randomised trial was proposed to be done on the island of Lombok in Indonesia, where it was known that they had quite high rates of pneumonia. The Lombok study was developed by two men, Jim Maynard, who at that time was working for PATH, but later went on to lead be the first co-director, in fact, of the Gates Children's Vaccine Program for Mr. Gates. And the other was Philippe Stockel, a Frenchman who still runs a French NGO called AMP. And with funding through USAID, AMP, the American organisation PATH, the program for, I forget what it stands for now. I think it's something to do with, it's just called PATH, and the Gates Foundation, and with vaccines coming free from Pasteur Meriot, with minimal involvement from WHO and very minimal involvement of the industry, this study went ahead. And the plan was to do a study based on the Gambia study, but on the island of Lombok, which looks like this, essentially a randomised controlled trial. Now, the island is dominated by this volcano, which hasn't shown up very well. The capital and most of the people live around here, but most of the island was actually involved in this trial. It was a big trial. Now, Lombok is a curious place in Indonesia. It remains to this day one of the highest mortality places in Indonesia. I think only West Papua has a higher child mortality. And at the time when this trial was done in the early 2000s, the child mortality rate in Lombok was higher than Gambia. And that's without significant malaria. These were the causes of death that were determined, and I think it's probably still the same. About half of them were due to pneumonia. So pneumonia and CNS infection, which we can read as being probably meningitis, were the dominant causes of death. So the ideal place to do a vaccine trial for a vaccine that's supposed to prevent pneumonia and meningitis. The study was, as I mentioned, a cluster randomised trial. So instead of individuals being randomised, the areas were randomised. In fact, they were hamlets in Lombok, and there were 818 hamlets that were randomised into these two groups. One group received DTP HIB, and one group received HIB alone, same as we'd done in Gambia. The sample size was a bit larger, 55,000 children in this. So the results were interesting, and probably the other thing to mention is that in contrast to what we'd done in the Gambia, remember we started the Gambia with the kind of endpoint that the regulatory agencies and the companies would want. In other words, a bacteriological endpoint of proven bacterial disease. When we started the project in Lombok, we were at the other end now and started with the radiological pneumonia endpoint, which had proved to be the most important finding in the Gambia. In the study then, they looked at meningitis rates and found that although very few children in Indonesia are actually diagnosed with HIB meningitis, there are a lot of children who are diagnosed with purulent meningitis which failed to grow anything bacteriologically, and this is because of the bacteriological conditions there. And in fact, what they showed was about 50% of those cases were prevented by the vaccine. Turning that around a different way, it means that retrospectively you can say that 50% of meningitis cases occurring in that community were caused by HIB, even though they failed to culture the organism in the vast majority of cases. So this was a very useful result, which on its own is probably been responsible for the introduction of HIB vaccine into Indonesia. When we looked at clinical pneumonia cases, and clinical pneumonia in this context were children who had cough and fast breathing, when we looked at clinical pneumonia cases, you can see a huge number of cases were detected. These are rates of disease, but still very high rates of disease. 38,000 cases per 100,000 children under 2 years, I haven't mentioned it there, but under 2 years per year. So out of every 100 children, 38 had an episode of clinical pneumonia every year. And as far as I understand it, that's still the situation in Lombok. And you can see that the numbers are almost the same in the vaccinated and control group, but there was a slight reduction, and that the numbers are so high that that slight reduction still translates into a lot of episodes of disease prevented. But what kind of disease was prevented? Well, the primary endpoint was radiological pneumonia, but in fact, what this slide shows is that the results showed us the opposite of what we expected. The rate in the HIV vaccinated group was actually higher than the rate was in the unvaccinated group. And this particular finding threw the field into a bit of chaos. And no one really knew how to interpret this. Certainly the primary endpoint of this study failed. And those people who were arguing that HIB is not an important cause of pneumonia in Indonesia and countries like that were somehow vindicated. So, we move a couple of years forward, and in 2000, the whole field changed. Everything in this field changed in the year 2000. And it changed, I would say, largely because of the appearance on the scene of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation from Seattle. Now, the Gates Foundation initially made some reasonably substantial investments in the childhood vaccination area, but the first really big thing that happened was that they put $700 million on the table for what became Gavi, the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunisation. Their $700 million was quickly matched by very large donations from mostly from countries, Norway, a number of European countries, and now most donor countries give money to Gavi. So this became an organisation dedicated to the introduction of new vaccines into the developing world with a big budget. Now, despite the big budget, and despite Gavi having made it clear that to the 74 countries, the 74 poorest countries in the world to which they would provide support, they were prepared to provide free of charge HIV vaccine, only a very small number of African countries took up the offer, and no Asian countries took up the offer, which was kind of interesting. And this was, I think, disturbing for Gavi. And in 2005, they essentially awarded a special project to try and, in the words that we used at the time, to support evidence-based decision-making with regard to HIV vaccine introduction. And this project was worth $37 million and was jointly awarded to the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, where I was leading that component, and Johns Hopkins University. And one component of the project was $7 million was put on the table and said, this is specifically to do a HIB probe study, in other words, another study like the Gambia and maybe like Lombok in India. And that was a definite recommendation, but that study was abandoned, unwisely in my view, in 2007 for complex reasons that would require another hour-long discussion. Instead, people relied on this study, which had already been funded. Now, this was a case control study done in Bangladesh, funded by the Asian Development Bank. And this particular study was, as a case control study, it looks at the rate of vaccination in children who have disease, in this case pneumonia, compared to children who are controls, in other words, the general community. The results of this study surprised everybody, especially me. Firstly, that the vaccine seemed to prevent double the amount of pneumonia that it had prevented in the Gambia. And this is in Bangladesh, where I don't think any cases of proven HIV pneumonia had ever been identified. Furthermore, it prevented 70 to 80% of all culture-negative meningitis, which we know a substantial proportion of those would have been pneumococcus, so the results didn't make sense. Excuse me. And I would say that these two results were implausible. So this raises a question which is relevant to the present day, and that is that why is it that case control studies of vaccines to prevent diseases like pneumonia always seem to give unrealistically high results? And this question has been the subject of a number of international meetings over the last 12 months. And basically there are two problems. The main problem is that vaccinated children are fundamentally different from unvaccinated children. So if you go into a community where 70 or 80% of children are vaccinated, the 20% of children who are not vaccinated are fundamentally different, not only in terms of the levels of poverty, of other risk factors, but also in the way that their parents handle illness, the way their parents go about care seeking, many aspects, they're completely different. And controlling for this in a case control methodology has proved to be extremely difficult. The other problem that the studies have is the choice of controls. And this is perhaps a little bit too detailed for this talk, but I've gone out into the field with some of these groups collecting controls in case control studies, and it is much easier to find a vaccinated control than it is to find a randomly selected control. What I mean is if the system tells you to go to that house and find a child, if the child is in that house, or go to the next house, etc., it's very likely that the investigators will find a control who actually has a health card, who has a mother sitting there looking after the child. In other words, the perfect parents are much more likely to be controls than the poor parents. And so you finish up with an overestimation of vaccination rates in the controls. And both of these things have the same effect, and that is that the poorer the study, the higher measured effectiveness. And personally, when I'm looking at case control studies for pneumonia now, I have not yet seen one that I think even gives us an indication of what the true effectiveness of the vaccine is. So for Asia and HIB, we're sort of back to square one. When we get to 2013, what issues are still there? Well, the need for a booster dose is still unclear. It hasn't been resolved. Several of us here know, in the Gambia over the last 2 years, there has been a resurgence of HIB cases. And it's starting to look like evidence is emerging that a booster dose will be needed. And if that's needed for the whole of Africa, that is a big issue, because that would mean introducing a dose in the second year of life in most countries where such a contact point does not exist. The HIB in Asia question remains unresolved. 23 years after the vaccine has been introduced in the United States, it's not used in China, and it's hardly used in India. So, you know, it's really a diabolical situation. In India, the government has introduced a vaccine in two states, Kerala and Tamil Nadu. You could argue from an equity perspective that these are the two states that need the vaccine least, because they have the best health care and the best health outcomes, but nevertheless say that those are the two states that have the vaccine. A number of other states listed there have sort of started the introduction process, and the government is trying to push it forward now, but problems are emerging. And this problem didn't start in India. It probably started in Sri Lanka, actually, some years ago. But there has been an increasing association of the introduction of pentavalent vaccine, that is the DTP, HIB, hepatitis B, five-valent combination vaccine, with early infant death. Now, none of these cases have really been proven, and in all the places where this has been reported, they have been settings where infant mortality rates have declined rapidly, leaving behind children dying not from diarrhea and pneumonia so much as perhaps cot death. So in places like Kerala, where the infant mortality rate is now 10, those children who die, they are probably random events occurring in the first 6 months of life, a time when vaccines are given. So that association has now appeared with vaccination, which was not there before. So now we have this kind of thing, and I want to read you this because this is the kind of thing we're dealing with now in India. And when we think about India, you must recognise that this is one quarter of the world's population. It's a big country. And this appears in the current issue of the Indian Journal of Medical Ethics. It says, if the birth cohort of 25 million were immunised with pentavalent vaccine, 1 out of 8 to 10,000 would die of AEFI. So 3,125 children would die, whilst only 350 lives would be saved by the HIV vaccine. It's an extraordinary claim, and you could say, what's this about? Well, AEFI, what are they talking about? This has got into the literature now throughout Asia of the anti-vaccine advocates. And AEFI stands for Adverse Events Following Immunisation. It's part of the kind of lingo that we use doing standard GCP vaccine trials. It means that if anything happens to a child who's been vaccinated in a trial, you refer to it as an AEFI until proven otherwise. It's not saying that it's related or caused by the vaccine. But somehow AEFI has now come to be like a diagnosis. And in Vietnam, it's become really a major problem. People are talking about AEFI all the time as if, don't get your child vaccinated or he might die of AEFI. And yet there is not one single case where I think there's been a proof that the vaccine has led to sudden death of a child. These are coincidental deaths occurring in large populations. But it's a kind of a misinformation that's sweeping through Asia and is a real problem. So coming back to the subject of this talk, who is doing the vaccine research and how has that changed? Now, In those years that I was describing the work from on HIV vaccine, you can see that most of the vaccine research was supported by WHO, UNICEF and NIH. In 2000, everything changed, and it's supported by Gates and industry. And increasingly, industry is controlling the trials that are done in the developing world. In the last few minutes now, I'll describe for you what's happened in the pneumococcal field, which is exactly 10 years behind the HIV field. Pneumococcal vaccines are more complex, but they're sort of similar. The main problem with pneumococcal vaccines is that you have many serotypes, and the current vaccines contain either 10 or 13 of the 93 possible serotypes. So this leads to problems with effectiveness, which are related to the number of serotypes covered by the vaccine in the community in which the vaccine is introduced. The pneumococcal vaccine was originally developed by a company called Praxis Biologics, but with a grant from US NIH specifically to develop a vaccine for use in Africa. That was the way it was presented. And they were presented a list of the most common serotypes in Africa based on studies done during the 1980s. And the first two serotypes on the list were serotypes 1 and 5. Vaccine was developed during the 90s. Wyeth took over Praxis in the early 90s. And one of the first things that they did was say, well, this needs to be a vaccine for the American market, and serotypes 1 and 5 are not important in the American market, therefore we'll drop them. So even though the vaccine had been developed with 1 and 5, they were dropped from the vaccine to produce the 7-valent vaccine, which in my view was an act of something like industrial vandalism. They had promised through the late 1990s that they would be developing a 9-valent global vaccine. A 9-valent vaccine was trialled in the Gambia and South Africa, but was never taken to market. Meanwhile, the issue of serotype replacement emerged very quickly after the vaccine was introduced. And this is data from Britain that shows the sort of thing that happens. The vaccine, these are meningitis cases, pneumococcal meningitis cases. After the vaccine was introduced in 2006, we saw a rapid decline in cases caused by vaccine serotypes and an increase in cases caused by other serotypes. Much better data more comprehensive data was presented from America, and you can see here that the vaccine serotype disease disappeared a few years after the vaccine was introduced here, meanwhile non-vaccine disease went up, and the net effect was about 20 or 30% of disease was still left. More recently, this has been studied in all of the countries that have introduced these vaccines, and this is as yet unpublished data from CDC, which shows that the in an analysis of 19 countries, vaccine serotypes went down very nicely, and in the older age groups, that is the parents and grandparents of the children who were vaccinated, there was also a nice decline in the incidence of disease caused by those types. However, when you look at the non-vaccine serotypes, and here if you look at under 5 age group, you see this curve here, which shows that the incidence of disease in non-vaccine type disease in children has gone up. So the most important question is, what is the net effect? And the net effect is that you finish up with about 40% of what you started with. So it's about 60% reduction. So this is a class of vaccines, unlike HIB, which virtually wiped out the organism. This is a class of vaccines which at the moment, is in developed countries at least, seems to produce a substantial reduction, but not a disappearance of the disease. So there are a number of questions, a lot of key research questions, and who's going to answer them? Does the vaccine prevent pneumonia? Is a vaccine effective in HIV-infected children? What's the most appropriate schedule? How can serotype replacement be detected? And how can it be minimised? And again, what is the disease burden in Asia? I must say, when I travelled through Indonesia earlier this year, talking to people about pneumococcal vaccine, there is a strong belief there that there is no pneumococcal disease at all in Indonesia. So there have been a number of trials conducted, and I just want to really highlight who did the trials. In the US, we had the main trial for the licensure of the 7-valent vaccine was done in North California, and that was funded by industry. There was a study done in the Navajo people, which was jointly funded by industry and US government. The Gambia study was done, this is the Gambia pneumococcal trial now, which Philip was involved in, was funded jointly by NIH, USAID, WHO and the British MRC. The South African trial supported by industry, and the Philippines trial was supported by the European Union. With the exception of the first trial, which was the one that the licensure of the vaccine was based on, all of the others were stopped early, and for different reasons, and that again would be the subject of another talk. But I would say that at least that the industry had some role in most of those decisions. The last of these trials, the one in the Philippines, was done with a 11-valent vaccine that was produced by Pasteur Meriere, and the vaccine development was stopped while the trial was underway for no really good reason, in my opinion. So all of those trials were planned in the 90s and were all complete by 2005, nearly 10 years ago. So since then, we've had only one large trial in this incredibly important area, which is currently consuming billions of dollars of international money. That one trial was funded by, and in fact entirely conducted by, the GSK company. And it was a trial conducted in Argentina, predominantly, a double-blind randomised trial with their 10-valent vaccine, which is the vaccine in use in this country. The results of that trial are quite interesting, but the main thing to look at here is that when we look at chest X-ray confirmed pneumonia, they showed a 23% reduction in pneumonia cases in Argentinian children. And when that was compared with the other trials, I've shown you here a remarkable consistency between the trials with the Californian data, the South African, the Filipino, and now the Argentinian data, showing roughly the same proportional reduction in cases. You should say, well, a 21% effective vaccine is not very good, but actually it's a reflection of what proportion of disease is actually pneumococcal in origin. It doesn't mean that the vaccine is 21% effective, it means that it prevents 21% of all radiological pneumonia, and it's a slightly different concept. The Gambian study is the outlier with a much higher figure. And my interpretation of that is that in the Gambia, the contribution of pneumococcus to the burden of pneumonia is probably higher than it is in the other places. So, how many of these questions have we successfully answered? Prevention of pneumonia has been answered. Effectiveness in HIV-infected children was shown very nicely in the South African study. What is the most appropriate schedule? This is the last thing that I want to address. We had a go at this. This was recognised as a problem in the mid-90s, but no research was being undertaken. So with support from NIH, we actually started a program of work in Fiji to address this question. What is the best schedule? Because we took the view that four doses of this incredibly expensive vaccine was probably unnecessary and might even be unwise. I don't need to tell this audience where Fiji is, but again, as one of the earlier speakers said, when you give this talk in the United States, you have to show that. These are the main results, okay? And these are the antibody responses to children who received either one or two or three doses of vaccine. And the important finding is to look at the two blue bars. That blue bar is two doses and that blue bar is three doses. And for most of the serotypes, there is no difference. For some of the serotypes, the three dose groups seems to do better. That's for 6B, this one here, 6B and 14. But interestingly, for this one, the two dose group does better. Now, this trial, which actually I've only shown you one slide, there's hundreds of slides of data on this trial, but this information, as well as some data that came from Israel and a couple of other small studies from the UK are the only studies addressing this question. But nevertheless, it has had quite a substantial impact. And the Pan American Health Organization, for example, now is more or less recommending countries to use what we call a 2+1 schedule, where they use only a two-dose primary series, to a certain extent based on this kind of data. We believe, and I think with some justification, that the review of WHO schedules, which is currently underway, is in part stimulated by this research. So what about the other questions? How can serotype replacement be detected? There hasn't been, in my view, a coherent research program to address this. And I think that there should have been. It seems to me that this is the one thing standing in the way of pneumococcal vaccine introduction globally. And I've seen specific aspects of this addressed, but not a coherent program. We have a grant from the Gates Foundation to look at the, to try and develop better microbiological methods to address this. But the real question is, how can serotype replacement be minimised? I mean, it's plausible that some vaccines may have a greater propensity to replace serotypes than others, and replacement might turn out to be incredibly important in the developing world. We really don't know at the moment. There's no data. We are starting to do some work on this subject, but I suppose what I'm saying is that in the current funding environment, there has not been a coherent approach. I feel that if we turned the clock back 15 years, we would have had around the table the same groups that we had in the early to mid 90s, and these kind of things would have been nutted out. But instead, a lot of these questions now are addressed behind closed doors in Seattle and elsewhere, and there's no, in my opinion, no coherent approach to this. And of course, the disease burden in Asia question still remains there. One study which we've been involved in, which I hope will become a prototype for India, is something that will be started in Mongolia within the next few months, where a part of the capital city will receive the vaccine and part will not. So it's almost like a trial. It's a trial which, to some extent, resembles the veterinary presentation that we saw earlier today, which I was really impressed with. But it's in Mongolia, it's organised by the government, and they want to know the effect of the vaccine in their community. So that will be starting soon. But the bottom line here is that there have been no major studies undertaken since 2005, at least with public sector money. And I think that's incredible. So coming back to this funny graph of who funds what, Gates and Gavi is not just Gates now, it's also a number of, it's mostly funded by bilaterals for rich countries. Gates and Gavi are the ones in the driver's seat now. These guys have all dropped out, really. And in fact, the main point I want to make, though, is that within Gates and Gavi, I believe that there's been some confusion between advocacy and science. And especially we've seen a lot more advocacy from these groups than the traditional advocates for vaccination, which was UNICEF. We see advocacy then mixed up with science, and a lot of the science that has been supported in the early 2000s in this field has been done with advocacy in mind. In my view, that's a mistake. They should be separated, but it's another question. So in this talk, I've not addressed a lot of things in this field. I've only addressed epidemiological research needs. I've not addressed the questions about the background epidemiology that should be conducted before vaccines are introduced into countries. I've not addressed the question of economic studies, which I think are extremely important and should be done. And I've not addressed the question of the safety of new vaccines, apart from the discussion we had about HIB. So there are other areas of research as well, in addition to these effectiveness issues that I've raised. So in conclusion, in my opinion, there's been a shift in funding responsibility for vaccine research in developing countries. And it's a shift which has really made a big difference to the way things have been done. Instead of a combination of groups like WHO, NIH, and bilateral agencies, the British MRC, the Wellcome Trust, etc., being responsible, we now have a much closer group, which is dominated really by Gavi and the Gates Foundation, is taking responsibility, and a much stronger role of industry. The new order is strongly focused on advocacy, and has been reluctant to take on large new studies. I mentioned the big study in India that was abandoned. There was another large pneumococcal vaccine trial in Asia that was being planned in the early 2000s that was also abandoned. There's an increasing reliance on model data as a substitute for experimental or field data, and this is going to be much of the subject of my talk tomorrow. And I think that the move has paralleled a decline in involvement of WHO and NIH NIAID. And in fact, I had a discussion about this with a high-level group at NIH in Washington some time back, and they admitted that. They said, well, now that the Gates Foundation is working in this area, we don't feel it's necessary for us to support any of this work anymore. So in many ways, the responsibility has been handed to the Gates Foundation. The Gates Foundation have done an enormous amount of good, don't get me wrong, but the problem is that their presence has, in a sense, scared off the other players. The increasing role of industry is something that I've alluded to a couple of times. Increasingly, industry is controlling the way that the research is done. And I point back to the Gambia HIP trial. We would never have got those results if that had been an industry trial. And in fact, the study that we're about to start in Vietnam, which I haven't talked about, is a study addressing aspects of responses to these vaccines which are really have never been addressed by industry, because they do the minimum. They do what's needed for only two purposes, for licensure of the product in the first instance, and then for advocacy, or if you like, advertising. And so really having industry control a research field is, in my view, very dangerous and very unfortunate. Safety surveillance in developing countries does fall to WHO, but WHO at the moment is rather poorly equipped to take this on. And safety surveillance, especially when we get to the vaccines I've not talked about, malaria and dengue, becomes incredibly important. So finally, just to repeat, I think that the confusion of science and advocacy has been a major problem for the field. I sense that in contrast to the situation 20 years ago, when WHO was clearly the lead agency in vaccine research, there is now no lead agency in vaccine research, and no clear kind of coordinator. And I would just underline again that the monitoring of effectiveness and safety is becoming an incredibly important issue, not just for pneumococcal vaccine. The same thing applies to rotavirus vaccine, to HPV vaccine, to the pneumococcal vaccines, and of course to the dengue and malaria and the other new vaccines that we'll see coming along in the next 10 years. So I'll leave you with that, and thank you very much for your attention.